thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. If there was a relatively simple method for extending the range, increasing the payload, and lengthening the endurance of combat aircraft, don't you think military planners would be interested in it? You bet they would. And it turns out there is such a method. It's called aerial refueling from a big wing tanker like the KC-135 Stratotanker or forthcoming KC-46 Pegasus. In-flight refueling began as a barnstorming trick a century ago, but is now a vital element of global military air operations. And who better to discuss the history, practical applications, and strategic implications of aerial refueling than the guy who not only wrote the book on big wing tankers, but even helped stand up the U.S. Air Force Tanker Weapons School. It's all coming up this week on the Fighter Pilot Podcast.
Roger that, disconnecting now. 87.5.
All right, disconnect, disconnect, down to the right.
Copy.
Welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. Now, here is your host, retired U.S. Navy fighter pilot, Vincent Aiello.
Hello and welcome to the show. I am your host, Jello, and this is episode 85. We're talking big wing tankers today with retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Mark Hassera. Now, in the last couple episodes, the guest has joined us right away, but today we're back to the old format. We've got some announcements, a couple listener questions, me rambling a little bit, and then we'll get to the interview. Well, I hope everyone's doing well here as we enter summer of this turbulent year of 2020. Man, it's been just crazy. As for me and my household, we're doing pretty well. We've got the boys. We've had a couple trips doing things as the city and state reopen, and so things are going pretty well. My job as an airline pilot, however, is a bit up in the air in the moment, if you'll excuse the pun. You know, the demand for air travel has been really hit hard in March and April and May. It's starting to come back, but as of right now, my company says they have more pilots than they need, and so there's a chance I might be furloughed in the fall. But if it comes back as quickly as it looks, maybe that won't be a problem. So anyway, a little uncertainty for me, but thankfully I have this podcast and other exciting activities to keep me busy, including recently I was featured on Vanity Fair. I don't know if you caught that or not. We posted about it on our Facebook page, but they invited me to review some military flying scenes from some popular movies, and they put that on their YouTube channel. It was a lot of fun, actually. We recorded it right there in my house. Part two should be coming out in early July. They actually presented the posts that I recorded in an order different than the way I recorded them. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but overall, it was a lot of fun. And you'll actually see me, and I will announce it, but there's another company that invited me to reflect on some movies. So that seems to be the trend right now. Well, let's see. In other news, this past week was not a particularly good one for U.S. military aircraft. First, an F-15 crashed in the North Sea, taking the life of First Lieutenant Kenneth Allen. Naturally, our sincerest condolences go out to the unit, and especially the Allen family. Then, a two-seat Super Hornet from the carrier Theodore Roosevelt crashed, but I read the crew was safely recovered, so that's great news. Now, regarding the show, many people commented that they enjoyed the EA episode with Mini-Me a couple shows back. I appreciate the feedback. And a few matters came up regarding the episode 84 on the Mirage 2000 last week. Now, first, some listeners appreciated the intro, but others thought my comments were insensitive. Now, I certainly did not intend to offend anyone. We simply want this show to be a place to enjoy and learn about military aviation. So going forward, we'll just steer clear of anything controversial like this. Enough said. Now, during the armament section of that show on the GBU-49 that I was not immediately familiar with, a listener wrote to say it is essentially a GBU-12, which is a 500-pound class laser-guided weapon, with an inertial GPS kit and it can be deployed like a JDAM and is useful against moving targets, I'm told. So that's interesting. That wasn't in the inventory when I was in, at least if it was, I didn't know of it. And it probably came as I was busy doing my maintenance check flights on my last tour there. Next, a couple listeners felt Mateo and I did not do justice to the air-to-ground variant, saying the Mirage 2000D and its mission are as different as the Strike Eagle is to the F-15, and each of those had their own episodes. So we'll try to give the air-to-ground version of the Mirage 2000 a little love. And one of the things we learned is that the Mirage 2000D is scheduled for a midlife update that will upgrade its avionics and armament, allowing the D model to carry more weapons and the 1 and 2,000-pound JDAM, some new air-to-air missiles, and, quote, hopefully a new targeting pod, so said the person who sent that. So, yep, we'll see what we can do. Maybe circle back on the air-to-ground version of the Mirage 2000. And another listener said that regarding the Taiwanese Mirage 2000s, evidently due to political sensitivities, the aircraft had to be categorized as a defensive weapon. So it did not feature air-to-ground capabilities. It did not feature in-flight refueling capabilities. And, you know, apparently they've had a few mishaps, as has any fleet, frankly. But now there is talk that the Mirage 2000 in Taiwan will be replaced soon by the F-16V model, which I'm not immediately familiar with, but I know there are many F-16 variants. In other announcements, our four Facebook groups continue to grow and thrive. If you're interested in military aviation photography, or if you are an aspiring military aviator, we have groups for you, including one just for hopeful military aviators from Australia. So we have a group called The Ready Room, where you can just hang out and discuss recent episodes, current events, air combat in general. All of them have entry questions. We just want to give you a little something to get in the door. So if you skip those, you might not get through the door. But if you can answer those, then you can jump in the fray and get involved with any of the groups or all of the groups if they interest you. All right, why don't we cover a few listener questions? The first is an email from Neil Wheeler that I've had since last October, about 8 months ago. Neil, I'm sorry, but I needed help answering this one, and it took a little while. Neil asked, could you briefly describe all the VX squadrons by outlining where they are, what they do, what platforms they operate, parentheses, VX-31 has several, including SAR helos, and how a pilot becomes a test pilot? Well, Neil, regarding the second part of your question, I will refer you back to episode 22 with Recky, where we discussed how one becomes a test pilot. But regarding the squadrons, there are several. And we'll break them down, if you will, by developmental test and operational test. Now, developmental test, or DT squadrons, now those squadrons perform air vehicle and stores release testing, and they require qualified test pilots to do that. So these are what you would think of as far as figuring out where aircraft depart, what their roll rate limits should be, what they do in certain situations. And so, yeah, that's where a patch-wearing test pilot graduate will be involved. Now, operational test, or OT, on the other hand, is for fleet representative aviators and flight officers to take the product that has met the design spec at a DT squadron and ensure it is usable by the fleet and is tactically relevant. So let's go through a couple of these. VX-23, that's a DT squadron in Patuxent River, Maryland. They operate all models of the FA-18 and the EA-18G, also the F-35C and the AV-8B Harrier and T-45 Goshawk. They do flight envelope, carrier suitability, and stores release testing. Then you have VX-31, which is DT in China Lake, California. They're responsible for the developmental test of weapon systems and software for the Hornet, Super Hornet, and Growler. And yes, there is a SAR Helo detachment there that is responsible for search and rescue for the local training area there in the desert north of Los Angeles. Now, you have also in China Lake, VX-9 that does operational test, and they are responsible for the weapon systems and software coming out of VX-31 for the Hornet, Super Hornet, Harrier, and Lightning II, and they integrate with Top Gun and VX-31 to bridge the gap between the test community and the fleet. So think of them as the go-between folks. And in fact, the Hornet, I'm told, actually, the OT part of that is over with. It's just the Super Hornet now that is doing the OT. For VX-20 back at Pax River, that's developmental test mainly for big wing aircraft. Think the P-8 Poseidon, which is a navalized 737. Then you have HX-21. It's developmental test at Pax River. That's for rotary wing. And the newest squadron, I'm told, is UX-24, which is developmental test for unmanned aerial systems. So that's pretty cool. Then you have VX-1, which is operational test at Pax River for big wings and helos. And then finally, out at VX-30 in Point Magoo, you have OT, but it's mainly range support for nav air and nav sea testing. So think about the big testing that's going on just off the coast of California there, north of Los Angeles. All right. I hope that helps. And I certainly learned something too. And again, apologies for it taking so long. I also have a six-month-old email question from Elliot Atkinson, who submits emails quite frequently. He's from the UK, and he asks, how much difference is there from a pilot's point of view between carrier launches using a catapult and launches using a ski jump or flat deck with STOVL aircraft? Remember, that is short takeoff, vertical landing. Do you have to think differently about what you're doing with the aircraft, how you operate on the deck? Of course, the STOVL aircraft operate off much smaller decks more often, and I wondered how much that affects the way operations are done. So, Elliot, I hate to take a pass here, but it took me so long because I kept waiting to find someone who's done both, and I never really found anyone that did. So I'll have to leave it to you to draw your own conclusions. If you recall, way back in the beginning, we had several episodes on carrier operations. And then last year in 2019, we had Magua on to talk about the AV-8B, and we talked about the smaller decks. And I couldn't find anyone either who had done, let's say, Harriers from ski ramps, but also flat decks. I'm sure they're out there. I just never found anyone. So just never had a chance to fully answer that one, Elliot. But great question. All right, two emails. Let's follow it up with two phone calls. The first one is from Evan. Let's give it a listen.
Hi, my name is Evan Forte. I live in California. I want to call and ask you guys for a quick favor. There's a video on YouTube, a 9-minute video. It's a recording of the comms of an incident in Libya where two of our F-14s from our Navy shot down two MiGs in an engagement. And I just wanted to ask if you're willing to review it on an episode. I'm not asking for like a full episode, but if you could review it, it's a 9-minute video, and just give us your comments on how the pilot reacted in the situation. Was that a part of the advanced weapons fighter tactics, or was that something that he decided to do? Would it still be the same way? Like, the tactics, have they changed? And how do you feel about the engagement? Like, would you have done the same thing, used the same tactics, basically? That's all. Just a quick review. I'm not looking for like a full episode. If you already have it, please direct me to the episodes. Or if not, if you can't direct me, just say that you have it, and I'll just go diving through it until I find it. Thank you. God bless you.
So, Evan, you kind of put me in a spot here because I think I know which video you're talking about. But just to be sure, if you could email me a link to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com, then I can make sure I'm looking at the right video, because there's a couple shoot downs from that era and they have slightly different circumstances as you would expect. And I'd be happy to listen to it if you could send me the link and then reflect on it on a future show. But I don't want to attack the wrong target, so to speak. All right, next, let's take another phone call.
Hi, Vincent. My name is Ken McAllister. I'm a paramedic in Santa Clara County. I have two questions for you. Question one, on the B-52 Stratofortress episode, have you never, ever heard of a movie called B-52 Bomber? That's the question. It's a great movie that highlights the B-52 like crazy. Question two, any chance you can do an episode on pararescue? I know it's outside the fighter world, but the 129th here at Moffett Airfield, they do rescues all over the world, as you know, combat SAR, everything. But they also have been going out to the cruise ships and dealing with COVID. So I would be interested in hearing their particular gist on what's going on in the world. And I think it would make an interesting episode. Have a great day.
No, Ken, I'm sorry to say I've never seen the movie that you're calling B-52. I had to look it up in IMDb, and I found out from 1957 there was a movie called Bombers B-52. I assume you mean that one. I'm really not familiar with it. I'll have to check it out. Secondly, we have had many suggestions for non-military aviation topics like you suggest. One gentleman recently suggested a show on the space shuttle. And when Australia was burning at the beginning of 2020, as you may recall, we had several requests for shows on aerial firefighting and bomb dropping, if you will, with water. Now, clearly there is overlap with some of these, but you know, we're trying to stay within our niche. I mean, right now, we've still got a lot of topics to cover, and so I'm not saying no forever, but we just want to kind of stick within military aviation for the time being. But that being said, we are considering an episode this fall when hurricane season begins in the Northern Hemisphere on the WC-130, because it has the C-130 as its base, of course, but also some of the missions they do is kind of risky, like air combat. So we might feature that one. We're not sure yet. But that said, kudos to the guys and gals of the 129th and other pararescue organizations. We obviously certainly appreciate everything you do out there. All right, that will do it for listener questions for this week. Thanks, as always, for submitting them and for your patience getting them answered. Let's go to the feature segment now, an extensive discussion on big wing tankers and strategic aerial refueling. Here we go. All right, this week we are talking big wing tankers. Now, we've had a show on aerial refueling before, but we're going to follow that up, leverage it. And who better to come on and talk about this than the man who wrote the book on it, retired Lieutenant Colonel Mark Passera, call sign Sluggo. How's it going, Sluggo?
I'm doing great, Jello. How are you doing today?
Oh, man, I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for making this work out last minute. And yeah, you've been working on me for a while about this. Didn't you reach out a couple months ago?
Yeah, a couple months ago. I think I started last year, but man, you've had some great podcasts, though, like on the F-117. I will never forget the first time I refueled one of those and air-to-air mission planning and a lot of stuff that I've been involved with, particularly being at Kadena in Okinawa with three F-15 squadrons, an AWACS squadron, a helicopter squadron. I mean, we saw it all over there as an air refueling squadron. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know if you were around for SR-71s, but our guest on that one, Brian Scholl, talked about the limitations being the tankers and the different fuel. So I want to get to all of that, dude, but let's start with you. Where are you from? Where'd you go to school? What did you do in your military? Anybody in your family military before you? And what you doing now?
So hometown, Los Angeles, born and raised in Inglewood, California, raised in San Jose.
All right.
Come from a military family. My father worked in the defense industry for a long time. I used to have missile parts on the kitchen table when I was a kid.
Who didn't, right?
Yeah, who didn't, right? My grandfather flew in World War II, flew P-51s in World War II. And my uncle, Bob Jeffrey, was an F-102 pilot and spent 7 years in the Hanoi Hilton, got shot down 4 days before Christmas in 1965 on his very first combat mission.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Went to Brigham Young University during the golden age of sports. Danny Ainge was playing basketball. Jim McMahon was the quarterback, and Steve Young was the backup.
Wow.
Great years for college sports when I was going to BYU.
Yeah.
And then always wanted to go into the Air Force and fly. My love for flying started on the hood of my grandfather's Chevy Chevelle on Aviation Boulevard at the end of the runways of Los Angeles International Airport.
Uh-huh.
Watching the very first DC-8s, 707s, Lockheed Constellations, Lockheed Electras, Vickers Viscounts coming in as a kid. And I said, why work for a living when I can do this?
Shh, don't tell anyone.
I know. Don't let that secret out.
That's right.
Really wanted to fly 707s when I first saw them. You know, as you go through pilot training, everybody comes into pilot training, want to be a fighter pilot. I did not have a lot of flying experience before I got there. So I was kind of at the end of the pack and ended up flying 707s, KC-135s. Absolutely loved the refueling mission in the KC-135. Mm. I look back at my time in the KC-135, and I've shown you some of the pictures too. I always had my camera with me, mm-hmm. and I just loved the mission. It was just a lot of fun. And I got to see a lot of air refueling history going from Strategic Air Command, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit, being on alert with six nuclear-armed FB-111s wow. loaded with 2.5 megatons of thermonuclear attitude adjustment, as we called it, right. and five tankers next to them just waiting for the klaxon to go off. And retired in September of 2007 from active duty as a lieutenant colonel. Went to work for Rockwell Collins, now Collins Aerospace, designing cockpits for airplanes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, went as far in engineering as my political science degree would allow. And but really learned a lot about systems engineering. Mm-hmm. And I was leading a team of 12 systems engineers with my poli-sci degree and just had a blast doing that. And it was fun to see what was in the guts of the multifunction display and mm-hmm. later on doing services for the parts and stuff like that. As a matter of fact, our biggest contract was the HUDs for F-18s.
Oh, nice.
Out of Coronado.
I've looked through those just a bit.
You've done that a bit, I'm sure. And then we have the displays in the F-18 too. Nice. And now I'm in Utah, just literally moved like 2 weeks ago into a new place. And I speak professionally. I'm going to write some more books. And I'm starting a new company called Wall Pilot that does vinyl prints for the walls of your home or office that you can peel off and stick on your walls, kind of like fatheads.
No kidding.
But they're really detailed. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, we'll have to talk because I think my audience would love something like that. So when it's ready to go, you let me know. We'll get some folks headed your way.
Oh, we're doing it already, but we don't have F-14s or F-18s yet because they're really detailed. They'll have every rivet. They even have the stenciling on the sidewinders with the arming key on the missiles. Okay. I mean, they're really detailed. Yeah. But the thing about it is we can customize them. So we can do your squadron, Jello, with your name on it, your bureau number, and whatever weapons load you want on it too. You know, about an hour, hour and a half. And wow. we have a printer that we send them off to and they ship them out, and you can peel them off and put them on your wall, or some people just frame it as it is and put it up. And
that's cool. At the end of the interview, we'll get some information on where people can find you and the various things you're doing. So make sure you don't let me forget that. All right.
Sure.
And I think it's worth saying that you have had two appearances on Aircrew Interview with our friend Mike, as have I, actually.
Yes.
And so people who want to get a lot more detail, I think it was about an hour each, as I saw, mm-hmm. who want to check that out, they can. We're going to hit some of the high points of all that today. And again, this is actually arguably the first episode that we've had where we've kind of circled back and talked about something we've already talked about, but we're going to do it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think we should just begin right off the bat with how aerial refueling began in the first place. I mean, Dud and I kind of touched on it, but I think you have a special insight on this because again, you've written the book on this. So we'll talk about your book too.
I actually had an entire chapter just on the history of air refueling. And the more I dug into it, Jello, the more fascinating it was.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
The first air refueling happened in 1921.
So we'd been flying airplanes for what, about 20 years?
Yes. Okay. Uh-huh. Wes May was this gentleman's name. He walked off of the wing of a Lincoln Standard biplane onto the wing of a Curtis Jenny, walked through the wires, jumped in the back seat, took the 5-gallon gas can off of his back and poured gas into the tank. That was the first air refueling. And of course, everybody said, there's got to be a better way to do this.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people began exploring better ways to refuel. And everybody in the Navy that I know has been to Coronado Island. Back early in the history of U.S. aviation, the Navy had one side, the Army Air Corps had another side of Coronado Island. Mm-hmm. And the first really long-range air refuelings took place over Coronado Island with a gentleman by the name of Richter, who had actually put a fire hose inside another airplane with a big gas can. They dropped it out the floor to another airplane with a regular nozzle on it, and that's how they started passing gas. And they stayed up for 37 hours the first time they did it.
Wow. Just to prove the concept?
Just to prove the concept. And then began doing a lot more with it. And so after they had done it over Coronado Island, they went to the farthest northern city, town in Washington, and flew all the way down to San Diego just to say they could do it. Mm-hmm. And they did.
Well, they were pioneers.
Oh, absolutely. And then came the question mark, which was doing basically the same thing. And the airplane, the question mark, had these really famous Air Force, Air Corps people in it. Tui Spots was the guy that was running the show.
Okay.
He was flying with Elwood Pete Quesada as a young lieutenant. And the question mark stayed up for a week. They took off on the 1st of January and flew through the entire week. And fuel wasn't the problem. One of the engines threw a rod and they had to land on Friday. Okay. And there's a really funny story about this too, because Spots got drenched during one of the night refuelings and they didn't know what to do. They said, well, they got to take off your flight suit and all that kind of stuff. And so they did. And the next time the tanker came up to give them gas, mm-hmm. Spots was standing in the little hatchway above the airplane, goggles, boots, and a parachute. And that was it.
That sounds like something.
I know.
In the finest traditions of airmen everywhere.
And you would never get away with that today. But there he was with a smile on his face, you know, and here's the guy that's going to lead the 8th Air Force in England, the first chief of staff of the Air Force, literally buck naked waiting for the thing to come down. He had a big smile on his face.
Oh, of course. Well, he had the important parts. He had the goggles and the boots and the parachute.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens me. Okay.
Believe it or not, the first air refueling in combat happened in June of 1950 during the Korean War, when KB-29s with the English Flight Refueling Limited air refueling system, which was like a drogue system, refueled F-80s, RF-80s that were taking pictures over North Korea. Huh. And they did it off the coast of Wonsan. And they continued doing that, and they had a guy, I think he was in an F-84, who flew the longest at that time fighter combat mission, 12 hours in the seat.
Ugh, forget about it.
I know. And think about the seats that we have now versus the seats they had in the 1950s.
Oh, I can't imagine.
And you can understand how uncomfortable that was, okay?
Yeah.
But he expended all of his ordnance, dropped his 500-pound bomb, shot all of his rockets, shot all of his guns, and then was direct in traffic over North Korea, refueling off of a KB-29 that was coming out of Yokota Air Base in Japan.
Wow.
So that was the first combat air refueling. And back then, the boom was just coming into the Air Force fleet. The brand new Air Force was flying KB-29s, there was KB-29M and KB-29P. The mamas had the drogue and the papas had the boom.
Uh-huh.
And they had to do the boom because they just couldn't pass enough gas fast enough into the new bombers that were coming out.
Right.
The B-52s, the B-47s, B-47s is coming out. B-52s are on the drawing boards getting ready to come out. And Curtis LeMay, they actually put a hose in a B-47 and had another B-47 refuel off of the hose. And it took them an hour and 10 minutes to fill the thing up.
Jeez.
And that's when Curtis LeMay said, this dog don't hunt.
There's got to be a better way.
There's got to be a better way.
Yeah.
He went to Boeing and said, you guys got to come up with a better way. And that's where the boom came from.
Well, and I want to talk about that because, again, we touched on it earlier in episode 5, but you have the two different methods, and yes, you might be tempted to call it the Navy method and the Air Force method, but it's not really, because we have a Navy aircraft, the E-6 Mercury, that refuels with the boom style. But just remind us real quickly what the two differences are as far as the methodology, if you will.
Sure. Great question. So the Drogue air refueling system looks like a badminton shuttlecock.
Yeah.
It's a big round. The Navy calls it the Iron Maiden for good reason. It weighs 251 pounds, just the basket. All right. It's really heavy, as you know. Yeah. It's just like a hummingbird coming up to a bird feeder. Stick the probe in. Once we get the contact light, turn the pumps on. We plan for 1,000 pounds a minute.
Okay.
Through the hose. That has not changed much. Even in the KC-46 with their pods, it averages out about 1,000 pounds a minute. So that's what our rule of thumb is when we're doing drogue refueling. 1,000 pounds a minute, 3 minutes between each receiver, and that's how we come up with our timing for an air refueling evolution. Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The boom, we have 4 pumps in the KC-135. We can pump 6,000 pounds a minute through the boom.
That's 6 times as much, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. 6 times as much. It, again, it's because of the big heavy receivers like the C-5, C-17, the B-52s. And this was all done during the Cold War time period of the 50s and 60s. And Curtis LeMay says, we can't take 110 minutes filling up a B-52.
Right.
Even though they had KC-97s with booms, the problem with the KC-97 was they burn different kinds of gas.
Uh-oh.
The old reciprocating engines can't burn the kerosene that the jets do. So the KC-97 actually had great big tanks inside the airplane to hold the jet fuel, which they could not use because of their engines.
Wow.
And that's why Bill Allen, yeah, the CEO of Boeing, says we got to have a jet tanker.
Well, Sluggo, is there another piece to this, though, that a B-52, I would think, with a probe would have a harder time getting in the basket than I used to in my F-18. I mean, is there something to that as well?
Yeah, there is something to that as well, but it was the transfer rate that drove it.
Right, sure, yeah.
And LeMay saying, I can't wait 110 minutes to fill up a B-52 from 3 different tankers, because you have to remember, even with the KC-135, it takes 2 to 3 tankers to drop gas into a B-52. He holds 351,000 pounds of gas, something like that. It's a lot of gas.
It's like 3 squadrons of F-18s. I have to always put things in context for what I'm used to. All right.
Well, yeah. And see, I remember during Desert Storm, actually Desert Shield, coming over the top of the John F. Kennedy and saying, we were Tuna 5-4, overhead mother, we've got a 90K give. And I just heard everybody laughing in the background. 90K give? Yeah, we got 90,000 pounds for you guys, okay? I could hear everybody laughing in the background going, man, that's a lot of gas. Man, that's a lot of gas.
Yeah.
And it was.
Well, yeah. Well, to put things in perspective, on an hour and 15 or an hour and 30 cycle in an F-18 with 2 tanks, if I was lucky, I got 4,000 pounds from either our own tankers, or if you guys were somewhere nearby, we could go get it.
Mm-hmm.
But to have unlimited fuel, it would be like opening the store on Christmas morning and just saying, go take what you want, because we were always fuel limited. And you guys seem to have it in abundance, as you clearly stated there.
But that was our job, and that's what we wanted. We wanted to see as many of you come across the basket as we could. During Desert Storm is when we wrote up in the lessons learned, you have to put wingtip pods on this airplane. We can't do this with a single basket on the boom, because now we're drogue only. We have to be able to do boom receivers and drogue receivers off of the same tanker, and we have to make them all air refuelable so you can fill them back up.
Right.
Unfortunately, nobody listened to us. Okay.
Well, those warp pods came around eventually, because I can remember flying formation effectively with a wingman, and we're both refueling at the same time. So when did those come about?
Those didn't come out until about Kosovo in 99.
Okay.
Okay. So Desert Storm's 91, 99, we're finally getting warp pods on the KC-10s. The 135s still don't have warp pods. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a problem for planning. And I was one of the planners in the Vicenza CAOC, and it was driving us nuts because we'd have a KC-135R model taking off with 180,000 pounds of gas over the Adriatic. So that gave him about 110 K give, and he's only got the drogue on him, and that's all he can do.
Right.
Great for you guys, but in a combat search and rescue situation, which we had two of them, remember we had an F-16 go down and an F-117, it was problematic because we had all of these airplanes that had to go in and search for these guys, and it just created a lot of headaches.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about both those downings here on the show, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
Fortunately, by the time we went into Iraq for the invasion of 2003, the KC-10 had warp pods and the 135s had MIPR pods, but they were brand new and we hadn't worked all the bugs out of them. And we had a lot of basket slaps initially, because what we found out was the take-up reel springs were set at 5 feet of overtake instead of 10, like in your manuals. And so the Navy guys were coming up and hitting it too hard. And that's what was causing that sine wave. One of your air wing commanders off of the Lincoln, Casey Albright, really got after me one day. He goes, "Sluggo, we can't fight a war with your baskets slapping our canopies off." You know, and I'm sure you've known people that have had that basket slap, and they feel it through the whole airplane when it happens.
Oh, yeah.
Once we figured out what the problem was and everybody slowed down, it was really effective, particularly for the two carriers, the Truman and the Roosevelt, that were off the coast of Turkey, and that's all they had. And we put all the MIPRS pods for them, and they loved it.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved it.
So, Sluggo, I think a logical question from someone who maybe is not as informed could say, well, why not just have, if the boom method transfers fuel so much faster, why not just have that for the Navy as well?
Great question. And here's one of the reasons why. Your Navy plumbing in your fighters couldn't take 6,000 pounds a minute. It'd blow you off. One of the restrictions that we have for like the F-16, particularly when it's carrying something on its center line, is we can only use one pump because it's like the proverbial mosquito in the vein, okay? Mm-hmm. And it just blows it off, all right? So the F-15s have fairly decent plumbing and we can use two pumps. But even for our Air Force fighters, we can't put all four pumps on because the plumbing is not made for it. The B-52 was made for it. Mm. Same with your airplanes too. The fighters, you know, save weight, as you know, is a big deal. And so the pipe size is too small to handle 6,000 pounds per minute.
Yeah.
We can't do it. It'll just blow you off. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to keep you up there and keep you plugged in as long as you need to get the gas you want. And that's literally why we do it the way we do.
Sure. Well, there was another point I was hinting at, and that is, except for an aircraft coming up, we'll talk about the KC-46, you need someone in the back of the airplane to take care of the boom, because essentially, as I understand it, I've never done it, but as I understand, if I were in an F-16, I fly up to a certain position, and then the boom operator flies the boom into my aircraft, versus when I show up in my F-18, I fly up to the basket, and the boom operator at that point is mostly observing.
Yes.
So, for our, for our native tanking on the carrier there, we want to have an aircraft where we don't have someone in the bottom of the thing because the aircraft are generally smaller.
Yeah.
So you'll put a buddy store on an A4, on an A7, on A6, S3s, F-18s, and we have a method now where it requires fewer people, frankly.
Yes. And for the boom operator, you're absolutely right. For the Navy and a lot of the international partners that we refuel, he just puts the boom down, extends it all the way out, and we just hold it out there in front of you.
Right.
And you guys get to play with that moving target, you know, because I've always been told by all my fighter brothers, you will find the one cloud in the sky and drive me through it.
Oh, my.
And I'm sure that's happened to you a couple times.
Oh, gosh. That or I used to wear a yellow visor, so you would drag me through the setting sun, and I'd have to quickly try to reach up and raise my visor. But We just had Snowbird on the show, and he got his call sign from a beating with a basket scratch. So you guys have made a few call signs. You've had a few ornaments hanging over Ready Room chairs for the folks unlucky enough to come back with a basket. So anyway.
And the party favors have made it back to us every once in a while, too, where the drogue will end up on a maintenance table somewhere. And that's happened, too. I've seen that happen also.
Oh, geez, the shenanigans of all this.
But you know what, Jello? It happens with the boom, though, too.
Huh?
My very first Desert Shield mission was with a Saudi F-15, and he snapped the nozzle right off with a brute force disconnect. That brute force disconnect, you could feel through the whole airplane, and the pipe was just bouncing like crazy. And I've got a picture of our nozzle stuck in that F-15 receptacle. So don't think you guys are the only ones that do this to us, okay?
Well, and that's a bummer for you, because now you've got all this gas and no way to pass it, right?
No, we can't hook up with anybody. And the crazy, stupid thing is, we're probably too heavy to land, and we have to just dump the gas on the way home, which is exactly what we ended up doing. We were too heavy to land, and Our landing weight had to be below 220,000 pounds, if you could believe it. But we had to dump gas to get to that weight.
Yeah.
There was no nozzle out there, and the nozzle has the little poppet valve in it that keeps it closed. So all we had to do is just turn on the pumps, and gas was spraying everywhere.
Oh,
don't think that you guys are the only ones that take off with party favors every once in a while. It's happened with other receivers or receptacle receivers too.
All right. Well, Sluggo, here's what I want to do on this episode. We've been having some fun already, but I want to treat this a little bit like our aircraft series. If you're familiar with the show at all, we'll get an airplane on like the F-15.
Yeah.
And we'll go through all these different topics. But I never thought, with no offense to you tanker guys, that we would need to do a KC-135 episode and then turn around and do a KC-10 episode because they're going to be very similar, I would think.
Yes.
So I want to talk about those types of things. But first, particularly since, again, Dud and I on episode 5 spoke mostly of the tanking around the ship, I want to talk about like strategic aerial refueling. And I think, what, are there 5 doctrinal air refueling missions? Is that right?
Yeah. And let me go through those just really quick with you, okay?
Okay.
So out of our doctrine document, which is publication 3-17, Air Force publication, we have 5 missions. The first one is global strike, and it's just what you think it is. This is the nuclear missions that we would do, or the long range missions like with the B-2. Okay. Just before President Trump was inaugurated, at the very last few days of President Obama's administration, he sent 2 B-2s to Sirte, Libya. Both of them were bombing 2 different camps that were there around the city. They were loaded with 80 500-pound JDAMs in each airplane, all right, with a Predator overhead watching what was going on. And if I remember right, talking to the tanker lead planner, said they had 17 refuelings, and they gave them 995,000 pounds of gas during the mission. Okay, almost a million pounds of gas for 2 B-2s to go from Whiteman Air Force Base to Libya and back.
That's crazy.
That's a really good example of a global strike mission, a conventional global strike mission.
Okay.
When I came into the Air Force, we had the nuclear mission, which I talked about. We had FB-111s at my base at Pease. We had B-52s carrying the air-launched cruise missiles. The FB-111s had B-61 nuclear bombs, or what was called the short-range attack missile. And that's also a global strike kind of mission. Second mission is called Air Bridge. Obviously, when we go to war, you have to get all of the troops, beans, butter, bullets over there. And we create this tanker air bridge that leaves basically the Northeast, gets you across Greenland, Iceland, over to England or Germany. But in some cases, they will fly Strike Eagles straight from North Carolina to a base in the Middle East. Long mission, 15 to 17 hours, long time to be in an ejection seat.
Oh, yeah.
But that is a typical air bridge. On the 6th and 7th of March in 2003, Air Mobility Command tankers were refueling 120 fighters, bombers, and ISR airplanes simultaneously in the air heading over for the invasion.
Wow.
That is an example of air bridging. We also have what's called deployment support, which is the third mission. And that's a mission where a good example is the tsunami relief that we had when the big tsunamis went through Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. We had C-5s full of all kinds of crazy things. One of them was full of lumber and sheet plastic, Visqueen.
Wow.
From mm-hmm. literally nose to tail. And asking what that was, well, you know, Visqueen, really? It's what they use to make temporary shelters out of.
Right.
Those C-5s were deploying directly from Travis, refueling over near Alaska, then coming down near Misawa and Tokyo, and then once again down near Taiwan, so that they could fly into Utapau and drop off all their stuff. That's kind of a deployment support kind of thing, okay?
Okay.
Theater support is like supporting you guys.
Right.
Going in, dropping bombs, shooting missiles, taking out SAMs, where we'll set up in a racetrack pattern. It's always a left-hand turn.
Thank you.
I designed mine 70 miles long by 30 miles wide so that we could refuel you guys in your Hornets or the B-1, because the B-1, when it gets heavier, can't use 30 degrees of bank, has to go to 15 degrees of bank, which means we need a wider turning circle because mm-hmm. we're refueling at about 320 miles an hour also. So it has a great big turning radius. So that's why we made them 30 by 70.
Yeah.
And again, it's guys coming up, guys and gals coming up, dropping bombs, shooting missiles, ISR airplanes. And those are typically the anchors that you see like over Iraq and Syria right now. During the invasion, we had them all set up across the Saudi border. And about the fourth day is when we moved inside Iraqi airspace. I named all of the Iraqi airspace anchors after female country Western singers. Shania, Reba, Leanne, Martina, you know, they're all named after female country Western singers.
I think I do remember a couple of those, Martina, and let's see, my last time there was in 05.
Yeah, some of those actually were there for a couple of years.
Yeah.
The fifth mission we have is special operations support. These are usually very fascinating missions because a lot of times we do them low level.
Really?
At 3,000 feet, with 3 to maybe 6,000 feet, because the special ops guys, they don't want to be seen.
Right.
AC-130s, MC-130s, and so forth will refuel. And that takes a special certification. I was a low-level guy out of Kadena. It was really fun to do it, particularly out over the ocean. We were refueling an MC-130 once off the coast of the Philippines and went right over the top of a bunch of fishing boats, and they were scattering and jumping into wheelhouses like crazy. You see these two big airplanes flying down low.
Yeah. But
well, in those special operations missions, like for the MC-130, we'll fill it full of gas, and then it will go down even lower to refuel the special operations helicopters, like the 160th SOAR, special operations helicopters for the Air Force. That it used to be the Pavlos when I was in the,
right.
And they're a big helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
They would take that gas and go down low and give it to.
Now, you guys could do that, or was that KC-130s?
The MC-130s would do it.
All right.
They would do it. We can't go slow enough. And we're just on the edge even doing the MC-130s.
Gotcha.
We had to be below 220,000 pounds. And even then, we had to put the flaps down to 20 degrees so that we could slow down enough.
Okay. Gotcha.
And another planning factor for us is the boom does not have enough airflow over the rudder vaders below 190 knots. So, you know, sometimes we're like right on the edge, particularly when we're doing A-10s that were really loaded down, because we'd have to be about 210 knots if they had all 10 of their stations filled mm-hmm. with weapons. And that was slow for us.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Sluggo, which one of these would it be? And I'm going to take a guess, but if my squadron and I were going to deploy from the West Coast to, let's say, Iwakuni, Japan, mm-hmm. and we're just going to go with you the whole way, is that going to be a deployment support?
That's what it's going to be.
Okay.
And we call those coronets.
Yeah, that's right.
We've called those things coronets, you know, forever.
Yeah.
I came into the tanker fleet in 1985 and they were called coronets even then. And we had coronets for a lot of different things. Fighter movements, C-141s filled with troops, that was considered a coronet. KC-10s that were carrying cargo and had fighters on the wings that were going somewhere, that was considered a coronet also.
Wow. Okay. We didn't really rattle through them, but you guys can refuel almost everything in the inventory, right? I mean, even the presidential and strategic and other high-value aircraft.
Oh, yeah. Air Force One is air refuelable. The Airborne Command Post is air refuelable. I have never refueled any of those airplanes. A 747 fills the window up pretty good, though.
Oh, I bet.
It's a big airplane, but a C-5 is just massive. Yeah. C-17 is pretty good, but something your listeners will get a kick out of knowing. The C-5 can actually move the tanker by moving the boom. The airplane's so big.
Okay. The law of gross tonnage, huh?
Yeah, the law of gross tonnage. But their airflow over the nose of the airplane, we have to be really careful when they back out, because if they back out too fast, it brings us together.
Oh.
And it's really scary when that happens. I've only had that happen once to me. I even had the autopilot on, and I could feel the airplane dropping because, you know, you get light in the seat. Mm-hmm. And I punched the autopilot off and started climbing, and we did what was called a breakaway. And the word you never want to hear, breakaway, 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 because that means things have gone bad.
Yeah.
But it's only happened to me one time with a C-5, and that was during a training mission where the pilot backed up too fast. But we actually used to have a demonstration mission that we did where we were 90 degrees of bank with a B-52 hooked to the boom. And he was flying us by moving the boom back and forth.
See, I saw those pictures and I thought, no way.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, how do you guys do that?
We do it leafs, okay? And you go up one side, down the other, and literally the B-52 is just moving the boom back and forth underneath us. And then we had about a 1.5G pull, and then he'd go to the other side and the airplane would bank to 90 degrees. And every instructor pilot up until about the 2000-2001 timeframe, that was a typical maneuver when you went through instructor pilot upgrade.
Wow.
We call it the whiff. And so those pictures that you are seeing is something that all of us did up until 2001. It was really cool to watch it from the back.
You know? Well, I can only imagine, but did someone finally risk manage it out of your repertoire?
Yeah. When KC-135 combat crew training moved from Castle Air Force Base to Altus, when we became part of AMC, the AMC bubbas go, no, we're not doing this anymore.
Yeah. I mean, if something goes badly with those big airplanes and all that fuel, that's probably not going to be pretty. We have a listener question coming up about that in just a little bit.
Did you know an F-35 fighter jet is made up of approximately 50,000 fasteners? High-strength nuts, bolts, washers, rivets, and other aviation-grade fasteners are also used on spacecraft, race cars, and even do-it-yourself projects by hobbyists. If your next project at work or at home calls for mil-spec aerospace hardware, look to DNL Components Incorporated. DNL Components consults space manufacturers, engineering companies, and high-tech startups on hardware availability, application, and alternatives that may lower cost or be more readily available without compromising quality. DNL Components sources alloy steel, A286, titanium, Inco 718, and other Krez materials for bolts, washers, nuts, rivets, Hilox, hydraulic fittings, and more, or they can custom machine when you submit your prints and specs. Go to dnlcomponents.com to learn more and to schedule a consultation with Donnie or Larry. That's dnlcomponents.com.
But okay. All right. So I told you I wanted to ask about some of the aircraft. Now, three of them are pretty similar, but let's start with the KC-130. Now, we've had the AC-130 on the show. Mm-hmm. We haven't had a C-130 episode yet, but the KC-130, the MC-130, I mean, I guess it's a standard C-130, but they're going to do the drogue method only, right? They're not going to do
it. That is correct.
And I mean, what more two of there is it?
It's kind of set up like the battle Hercs in the Marine Corps. So they've got inboard tanks that are full of gas. They've got the pods made by Cobham out on the wings. And it's just for basket receivers. And they obviously can slow down and do helicopters or speed up and do F-18s. The MAGTAF just relies on those things heavily. And now, of course, even the Ospreys, the tilt rotors, can refuel off of the back of these things too.
Yeah.
So I've never done a C-130 refueling mission, but I have been in the helicopter that refueled off of an MC-130 out of Kadena at night, which was a lot of fun. It was really fascinating to watch air refueling from the other side. And they had their flaps down. What was really cool is they had the back troop doors open, and there's two guys standing there watching us. Okay. And we were only at 1,500 feet at night doing this off the coast of Okinawa. And it was really fascinating to watch. And again, the KC-135 would fill up the MC-130s. The MC-130s would go down to 1,500 feet and refuel the helicopters and give them all kinds of gas. And I did it one time when I was at Kadena. It was really a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't doubt it.
My KC-135 is one of the oldest airplanes in the inventory. Now, when I was stationed at Fairchild in the 2000-2003 timeframe, I came off the assembly line in May of 1957, and we had three jets on the ramp that came off in 56 and one in 55. So the KC-135 has been going for over 60 years and will go probably for another 20 years.
Wow.
They have upgraded the cockpits to it now. Mm-hmm. They have really spectacular glass cockpit with GPS and all the latest tools. And we have what's called TCAS, Terminal Collision and Avoidance System, in it. And we would actually do rendezvous off of the TCAS system.
Wow.
That's why you heard us ask you for your Mode 3. The tanker would ask the receivers for their Mode 3, because when you got within 40 miles of us on extended range, whoever was squawking those four numbers would show up on that 40 miles, and it gave us really good SA off of our TCAS system to see where you were coming at as we were flying the left-hand oval. Mm. And we could manage our pattern inside our racetracks by watching where you guys were coming in based on a Mode 3 of one of the guys or gals in your four-ship formation. It was a totally new way of doing rendezvous that the maker of it, Rockwell Collins, had no idea we were doing that. Mm. So it's been upgraded. It's got new engines.
Yeah,
the story of the engines is incredible. The CFM56 engines are fantastic engines.
Yeah, these aren't the old turbojets that you needed fresh water for, huh?
No. And let me just talk about that real quick, okay? So the J57 engines, we called the old A models water wagons, because we would burn about 5,500 pounds of water in 125 seconds to get us off the ground, all right? And it shook the whole airframe when we did it. Hmm. Imagine a heavyweight formation of four KC-135s taking off with 12-second intervals during a minimum interval takeoff. That was the SAC standard. Got really smoky, okay?
Yeah, I don't know how three and four could see down the runway.
And you'd have three airplanes on the runway. You'd have one just turning on, one about midfield, and one just breaking ground. Mm. But it was done to get airplanes off of the airfield quickly.
Right.
Because of inbound missiles. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The R model engines have given the KC-135 40% more gas available. The amazing engines. And the story of how we almost didn't get those engines is fascinating. There's a really good book out there called The Power to Fly that has the story of how GE and the French Snecma group got together, and they were within about a week of closing down the whole CFM56 program. And the French KC-135 unit says, well, we'll put them on our airplane. And that kind of started the ball rolling. Hmm. But the R model engines was a huge boost to KC-135 capability. We went from burning 13,000 pounds an hour down to about 10.
That's a good savings.
That's a really good savings.
Especially over hours and hours over multiple aircraft. But
yeah. On a longer mission, the KC-135R model can actually offload more gas than a KC-10, even though the KC-10 is taking off with 320,000 pounds, and we're taking off with 180, because it's burning it at 20,000 pounds an hour in the KC-10.
Wow. Yeah. So the KC-135, you said at the beginning, was based on the 707 platform, which, as I understand, is also the platform for the E3 Sentry,
yes,
as well as some of the J-STARS, and of course our E6 Mercury. Mm-hmm. But the KC-10, based off basically a DC-10, right? It's got the two underwing engines and one up on the tail. Mm-hmm. I mean, are they otherwise, I mean, in broad strokes, I realize there's a lot of commonalities and differences, but both great big airplanes adapted for aerial refueling. And
yes.
I mean, I don't know how much more we need to get into, but what would you say are the biggest differences other than the fuel you just mentioned between those two?
There's one thing that the KC-10s do that the KC-135s don't, and that is they could move a squadron quickly.
Okay.
It's called a deconfiguration. It's got 75 airline seats and all of their stuff, cargo, loaded in the back of the airplane. And so you'll have two or three KC-10s on some of these deployment support missions, Jello, that are dragging like an F-15 squadron or an F-18 squadron. And they'll have their maintenance people, all of their spare parts, all of their maintenance stuff and everything. That's one mission. They call it a dual role mission, where it's doing airlift and air refueling at the same time, which is one of the great things about the KC-10. And it'll be the, one of the great things about the KC-46, be able to do the same thing. We can air refuel it. We can dump gas into it. And on some of these really long deployment support missions, where an F-15E squadron is leaving Seymour Johnson on North Carolina, going all the way to the Gulf, it'll be behind KC-10s that are moving all of their maintenance people, all of their support people, all of their parts, all of their engines and everything on two or three KC-10s that are moving over there. And the KC-135s would hook up with them, give them 80,000 pounds of gas and send them on their way.
Gotcha. Yeah, so I have to ask the obvious question here, Sluggo. How are they able to carry all those people and all those things? Isn't the inside full of the fuel they're giving?
No, it's all in the floor. It's all under the floor.
So a lot like an airliner.
Yeah, it looks like a cargo plane, like an MD-11. So it's got a flat cargo floor. You can move all the pallets around. And like I said, in the deconfiguration, it'll put 75 seats and still have the cargo floor. You can always get back to the boom pod in the back. They got really nice soft chairs and really, you know, the boom operator's not laying down. And again, you can keep dumping gas into it. That's what makes the KC-10 and the KC-46 so valuable, is you can fill up the gas station.
Yeah.
The 135 only has 8 air refuelable KC-135s in the entire fleet.
Out of a fleet of how many?
We started with 732. I think we're down to 432 now.
Yeah, I think I saw some out at the Boneyard when I was there in February.
Yeah.
All right. Tell us about this KC-46 that's coming. It's based off the 767.
Yeah. So the KC-46, as you know, the competition, the Airbus airplane won the first competition. Boeing protested, won the second competition. KC-46 is going to do a lot of the same missions like a KC-10. Like I said, airlift and air refueling, dual role, but a lot of these same missions that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It has defensive systems on it. You'll know if you're getting shot at by shoulder-fired SAMs. It does not have expendables like chaff or flares on it, but it does have Link 16.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's really nice. They really did a good job of putting this together. During the competition, I had the opportunity to brief both Boeing and Airbus Northrop Grumman. And I made the same 6 slides that I said to both companies. The last slide was, here is what this airplane must look like after being a guy that has flown in 4 wars. And they did it right. Now, you've heard a lot of problems with the boom vision system. The boom has got problems in the envelope with heavy receivers, and they're working all that stuff out. I have no doubt that Boeing is going to fix it. Mm-hmm. How long it's going to take to fix it, I don't know. But they're working through all of those systems. And the big one right now is the remote vision system that runs the boom, because now the boom operator is up front in the cockpit. And that's not unusual, because the Airbus airplane has had that. The Dutch KDC-10 has had a remote vision system, and they've all worked out fine. They just got to work the bugs out of it. And the KC-46 is going to be a great airplane. I have no doubt.
That's good. I mean, there's always growing pains with new technology and
adapting
an aircraft that wasn't a tanker from the beginning.
No, so. Exactly. And you have to remember, too, when they made this particular airplane, they took pieces of all the 767s to put it into an airframe that had to go through airworthiness, and because it was a new airframe, because it has the better wings, the newer engines, the longer fuselage, all those kinds of things. So it had to go through an airworthiness certification just to be able to fly. And then we added on the missions and so forth. And Rockwell Collins makes the cockpit for it. And it's a great cockpit. It's a 787 cockpit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, really nice. I mean, it's got the heads-up guidance system, the really good glass, and it's a lot of fun to fly.
You're out of superlatives, Sluggo.
I am.
That tells me something. All right.
Yeah. But the Airbus airplane is too. I got to fly the A330 simulator when it was down in Melbourne, Florida, and it's doing great things too. Mm-hmm. All the countries that have it just absolutely love it. It has not had all of the growing pains that the KC-46 has had, though. And that's why you don't hear anything about the A330 tankers are doing famously. The Australians love it. It's won the last three competitions against the Boeing tanker, by the way.
Yeah. Well, so the U.S. doesn't have the corner on the market on big wing tankers, no. Right? I mean, you talked about a Canadian, Australian, obviously there are British tankers. There's even, yeah, of course, Russian and Chinese tankers.
Yes, there are. I actually have time in a VC-10 with the RAF.
That's awesome.
They were pigs. They were pigs.
You better qualify that statement. What do you mean?
They took off with 165,000 pounds of gas and burned about 16,000 pounds an hour. Very fuel inefficient engines.
Okay.
But great tankers, great crews. They have full up galleys on them. And so when we were flying Northern Watch missions over Turkey, mm-hmm, they had bacon and cheese sandwiches going out, you know, going out to the area out of the oven, and ham and cheese coming back, you know. And the basket operator, you know, he wasn't doing that. He goes, hey, you know, you want a bacon and cheese sandwich? Yeah, sure. It was just fun to fly with them to see how they did things.
Yeah.
And it was a basket-only airplane. And we were refueling the British Jaguars and the EA-6Bs off of the VC-10. Yeah. So I got two rides in it when we were deployed right after 9/11 to Incirlik, and just had a great time.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I did refuel off of one of those ones, yeah.
Yeah, and they have the nice, soft Nerf baskets, not the Iron Maiden like we do. It's really a nice tanker. Old avionics, though, really comfortable airline seats. And like I said, they're very fuel inefficient. And now, of course, the RAF flies the new A330 Voyager, which the Australians do. Singapore just got rid of all of its KC-135s and is now flying Airbus airplanes.
Okay.
Really good airplanes. And I actually was involved in the Embraer KC-390 build.
Not heard of that one.
The KC-390 is built by Embraer. It's a completely new airframe. It's twin-engine jet, high wing, so it can do airlift and air refueling through drogues. And it's going to be a really nice airplane. It has a 787 cockpit in it, the Fusion cockpit in it, and really nice airplane. And it's just going through its initial testing and so forth. So the Brazilians now have tankers that they're going to start selling too.
Does most of the rest of the world do the drogue system, or who else does boom?
The Australians do boom. They had F-111s. That was the reason why all of the F-111s are gone now. But they went ahead and put booms on all their airplanes anyway. And while they were over here, there was three airplanes that came over to do red flag out of Nellis.
Okay.
And one of them stayed and got all of its certifications to do B-52s, B-1s, RC-135s, AWACS, would not let them do the F-22s and the B-2s because of the material on the outside of the airplane. But they got all of their certifications to do all of the Air Force and Navy airplanes while they were here, which once they deployed over to Iraq and they're flying out of Al Dhafra, was huge because it's air refuelable, has a boom, has the wingtip pods. It's the perfect tanker. And the Australians did that all on their own.
Nice.
Yeah, it was. It was fabulous. And
that's cool.
The French and the British are actually thinking about putting booms on theirs now too.
Huh. All right. You talked about defensive systems. I would think something like a tanker, its biggest defense is listening to what's going on, maintaining situational awareness, and getting out of there before anything becomes an issue. And now on your aircrew interview with Mike, you talked about a time over Iraq where some F-15s checked in and save the day as you were getting a little nervous. But I mean, what else is there on these aircraft? If you're relying on chaff and flares as big as you are, I mean, no offense, but I don't see that being really effective.
No, it's not. And we rely on people like you, brother, to help us, to defend us.
Gladly.
Okay. We are probably the most over-defended airplane on the planet because we have all the gas. And when we moved all the air refueling anchors into Iraq, we did it on day 4. And it was really early. And we hadn't dealt with some of the surface-to-air missile science projects that Saddam had, and particularly the guns.
Are we talking 1991 or 2003?
I'm talking 2003. Okay. Sorry. I'm talking Iraqi freedom. So General Mike Mosley came up to me in the hallway and said, Sluggo, we have to move the tankers into Iraq. 19-year-old kids are getting shot at in Najaf, and the gas is too far south. We have to move them up. I said, well, sir, we can do that, but you know, I got to figure out how we're going to defend them and so forth. And he says, Sluggo, the tankers are going to have to take some of the risk too. You guys can't just sit back in Saudi and fly out the war there. We've got to move you guys up. We're having to fly too far to come get gas and then go back. It's taking too much time and it's taking too much gas to do it. I said, okay, when do you want this by? Tomorrow. Okay, sir.
Wow.
So we did the same thing, 70 miles long by 30 miles wide. The first two we opened were just on the other side of that disputed diamond area between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. We called it the Klingon neutral zone. We put two tracks right above that, Chennai and Reba. We really started to figure out how we could defend the tankers by doing that because they were getting shot at quite a bit, mostly by ground guns, unbeknownst to us. The multiple launch rocket systems were actually being shot over the tanker tracks, which was kind of disconcerting.
Yeah, I would say.
We just had to come up with procedures to take your systems that you had on board, your F-18 and the F-15 Strike Eagle, you know, the targeting pods, the radar, your warning systems and so forth, and share that information with the tankers. And what we did is like one airplane would refuel for the F-15s. Two airplanes would refuel while two were like down rooting around, making sure to keep everybody's heads down. Mm-hmm. And then they would switch. The A-10 guys got involved. And what we did was the A-10 started looking around, hunting for stuff underneath the tanker tracks. They called it the pig pen. We had three tracks right next to each other. They called it the pig pen. But it was the CSAR hogs. So it actually gave them an advantage because they were already airborne, already hunting for things. And if they had to go find a downed pilot or a crew, they were already airborne. We would immediately give them gas and off they would go. So it actually shortened their reaction time. Again, we were doing all this on the fly though.
Wow.
And then we got the special ops guys involved. And there's a really funny story about that. This unwashed, unshaven special ops guy sees an SA-8 coming down the highway, takes the javelin off his back, shoots the javelin missile at it, runs out in front of his team, turns around, and he's yelling at his bros, take a picture when the missile hits, take a picture when the missile hits. And they came and showed me that picture. He says, hey, the soft guys are taking care of you guys too.
That's cool.
That's how we did it. But we rely on you guys to help defend us and work out all those procedures. That's how we did it.
All right. So what you're telling me is that defensive stuff aside, again, your best bet is the pointy nose folks and the guys on the ground,
yeah.
The whole team taking care of you.
Yeah. The whole team has to take care of us, man.
Yeah.
We're like the baby in the crib with the bottle.
Well, but an important one. I mean, come on.
That bottle being the thing that you're going to suck on, not I'm going to suck on.
All right. Well, let's stop this before it gets a little too weird. But anyway, yeah. All right. All right, man. So golly, I mean, we've talked about the differences between the boom and the drogue. We've talked about the doctrinal air refueling missions. You know what we didn't talk about? There is an aerial refueling weapon school. Is there not?
There is.
And do you know someone who was involved in setting that up?
Worst 4 years of my career.
Oh, yeah.
But probably the most rewarding at the same time, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, all of the fighter guys at Nellis looked at us like, what in the world are you going to teach at a tanker weapons school? And we really needed a higher level, a PhD level tanker planner. fortunately, AMC knew that, and they cut a check to start the school. I was the XO of the initial cadre. And we began in 1999, moved to Fairchild Air Force Base, and we had a blank sheet of paper. It's like, well, what are we going to teach? What do we need to teach? What are the tools? What are the skill sets that the tanker guys need to have, tanker guys and gals need to have, that we don't have right now? And we were literally given carte blanche to come up with that. And that was difficult at first because we'd fought two wars, Desert Storm and Allied Force, with no tanker expertise at the operational level. We had the majority of the tanker folks did not know how to read an air tasking order. And now they're told we have to plan these great, big, huge air campaigns. And so it was a real pickup game. Mm-hmm. Fortunately for me, I learned how. I taught myself, but they didn't have anybody that knew how to construct air fueling tracks. I got the Navy portion. I was the only one on the initial cadre that had been on an aircraft carrier, and that's the reason I got that block of instruction. I didn't know where to start. Well, if you want to start, you go to the Naval Strike and Air Warfare Center.
There you go.
I went up there, called a guy by the name of Toast Bernie. I can't remember his real name.
Yeah, Will Bernie.
Mm-hmm. Will Bernie, yeah, okay. I went up there, and Toast showed me around and said, okay, here's what you need. And that's where I learned about the Naval Strike and Air Warfare Manual. And I thought to myself, why does the Air Force not have this? This simplified our life completely. And so what I did is I took your Naval Strike and Air Warfare Manual, did all of our ground school courses there. Then at the end of the day, we'd get on an airplane, go down to San Diego. The next day, we would tour a cruiser, find out how they're doing things. The AOC afloat ship at that time was the USS Coronado. We would tour that in the afternoon. And then that night, we'd put all of our bags on the carrier that we're going to go out to sea at. And we'd go out to sea for 2 days and a night so that our tanker guys could experience it all. Mm-hmm. We had 17 training objectives just for the aircraft carrier alone. So it was really tightly packed. But again, no tanker guys had been on carriers and understood how you guys did business, how you did long-range strike, how you guys defended the fleet, how you wanted to integrate the big wing tanker into the air wing operations. I left that school in April of 2001, and everything changed September 11th,
that's right,
didn't it?
A couple months later. Did you get a chance to go on the flight deck during carrier operations?
Oh, yeah. We took everybody up on the flight deck. We didn't just sit in Vulture's Row. We actually went out to the LSO platform.
Good.
We would break into smaller groups, and when they were shooting, our guys were actually amongst the guys where they were shooting the airplanes off. I mean, they gave them the whole experience.
Yeah.
We went down into CATSI, the Carrier Air Traffic Control Center, when they were doing all the night approaches and landings, and then again went back up on the deck when they were doing night approaches and everything, so they could see that.
Yeah.
You know, of course, they're all going, man, did we go to the right recruiter? You know, but at the same time, it was extremely valuable education for them. But we had 482 academic hours, 18 5-hour flights, a 3-hour sim, and a graduate level paper that they had to do in 19 weeks.
That's cool. So the idea being is when you wear that patch as a tanker pilot, the ability to, and the credibility to handle pretty much almost any mission, Air Force, Marine, Navy, right? All these different five tasks you guys do and all that.
Exactly. And here's an interesting story about that. One of our graduates, because we go down to Fort Bliss and we talk to all of the Army air defense experts down there about man pads and
threats and all that. Yeah.
Enemy threats, enemy SAMs and all that. And because we went on the Aegis cruisers and understood how you did things, one of our graduates actually was given the task to go to Israel to help with an air defense exercise.
Oh, wow.
Because he'd been on a cruiser, knew how the Navy did things. The Navy was taking part in this and understood how the Air Force did it, how the Navy did it, threat defense and all that kind of stuff. So he ended up being on the air defense group in this big exercise in Israel. The difference that that school made, Jello, between the planning of Desert Storm and Allied Force and the planning for Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom was night and day, you know, because we had people that understood how you and your F-18 did business, how the Navy was going to do their long-range strike planning, how the Air Force was going to do it, how our international partner was going to do it. And they are the air refueling experts. Setting up that school was tough. Nobody wanted us. Everybody thought it was a stupid idea. Squadron commander in the building that we were in came up to me one day and said, "This is the stupidest idea AMC's ever come up with. Why are you guys doing this?" And we were getting beat up quite a bit, but 9/11 changed everything. And now we've got these experts out there. There's 200 grads of the school now. It's been going for 20 years. Like I said, one of the toughest assignments I had was setting up that school, but it was one of the most rewarding things I did. And during my Air Force career, setting up a weapons school.
Cool. Well, Sluggo, this has been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot from you, and I know we could go on and on. I do have some listener questions I'd like you to cover, and I think we're going to save those as a lightning round for our exclusive Patreon audience. But before we go, I want you to tell people where they can find you. So first off, you wrote a book, right? Tanker Pilot, Lessons from the Cockpit. We're going to link to that on our shop page on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, but just tell us briefly what that book is about.
The book is 22 chapters on experiences that I had while I was flying the KC-135. The opening chapter is the first night of Desert Storm refueling the first Weasel package into Baghdad. But each one of the 22 chapters has like a moral value lesson learned, like humor, courage, innovation, initiative, those kinds of things, relationships. The other thing that's cool is I always had my camera with me, Jello, on the floor. When I retired, I had 4,000 color slides of pictures out the window, and some of them are really incredible. So there's 32 pictures in the book that I took during the missions that I'm talking about in the different chapters.
Nice.
There's two chapters about being on the aircraft carrier John F. Kennedy twice during Desert Storm, and then again right after Operation Anaconda in March of 2002. It talks about all the planning that we had to go through for setting up a lot of the missions, doing a humanitarian mission, and saving passengers on Korean Air Flight 801 that crashed short of the runway in Agana, Guam, and how the Air Force got its airlift fleet going to bring burn victims back to the States and fix them up. A lot of really cool stories in that. And like I said, each chapter has one of these lessons from the cockpit. You know, here's what I learned from this, and a lot of great pictures.
Well, that's pretty cool, because one of my favorite pictures in my catalog for my career is one a tanker pilot took for me after we came off, I believe it was a KC-135, and I'm waving to the guy, and it's such good resolution. You can kind of zoom in and see my traditional yellow visor and the my arm up. But, you know, when it happened, I pulled up and he goes, "Hey, pull up a little farther. I got a camera." Okay. And then he goes, "Hey, give me your email address and I'll send it to you." I said, "Yeah, sure, whatever." So, you know, I'm spelling it phonetically over the radio thinking I'll never see this thing. But now I love it. I use it all the time. I think we used it as the episode art for like episode one on the show. So,
oh, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys are awesome.
I've sent a lot of pictures out to guys that one guy later became a 2-star general.
Oh, cool.
Zot Dennis. And during a mission, he came in really, really close. You know, it kind of scared me because our wings are overlapping, because he's really close and he's up forward. That's normally not where they sit. And
right, and
he knew it was me, and I had my camera up taking pictures and everything like that. We got on the ground. I said, "Zot, how in the world did you know it was me?" And I said, "Sluggo, we can see your gray head for miles." It turned out to be a really cool picture too, with new snow on the mountains going around the turn and looking down at him and everything. It's one of those really cool pictures.
Yeah, that's good. All right. So we're going to link to the book for you. In fact, we had talked about it before we rolled tape, and I guess we can figure it out right here and now with everyone listening if you want. Do you want to give a couple of those away? We have a pretty cool system for doing raffles, and we have people sign up and a couple of them win. You can send a personal note and send it off to them.
Yeah, you bet.
Okay. Well, we'll figure out the details. And by the time this airs, the folks should be able to check the show notes and our social media for a giveaway. We'll do a couple books and we'll have you sign it, Sluggo.
I'd be happy to.
Awesome. Now, you also said you are a speaker. So where can people find out how to book you and what do you speak about?
I'm speaking on inspirational and educational things. One of my keynote speeches, aviate, navigate, and communicate.
There you go.
Never heard those three words, have you?
No, never. Yeah. All right.
Those are the three words that every pilot uses to get through an emergency. And I talk about how to aviate through the critical things in your life. I had a son that got cancer and unfortunately didn't make it. What it was like, you know, having to aviate through that kind of a tragedy. Yeah. Navigate. I actually got to drive the John F. Kennedy while it was underway. Refueling. And I talk about how to navigate through doing new things in your life, you know, and yeah, not fearing stepping in and learning new experiences and so forth. And that was really a unique experience to sit there in the Oxcon and with the USS Seattle next to us, taking on 1.2 million pounds of jet fuel and 300 bombs and 6,000 hot dogs. And then, you know, better ways to communicate both in the boardroom and in our personal lives, you know, aviate, navigate, and communicate. And I am right now building our new website. It'll be markhasera.com, and you can find me there.
Okay. Well, we will link to you, and that sounds great. Well, hopefully you can help you find some gigs, if you will.
Sure.
And then what about this wall pilot thing? Where can we find that?
Again, we're rebuilding the website now, and right now we're doing everything off of our Facebook page on Wall Pilot.
Okay.
On Facebook, and you can IM us what kind of airplane you're looking for, and more than likely we can do it. We have 13,000 profiles drawn.
Wow.
And but we customize them with your name, the unit that you want, the bombs or missile load that you want. I sent you two examples. They're really, really detailed, and they're printed on vinyl, so you can peel them off and stick them to your walls, just like the sports figures, fat heads. And
yeah,
we're having a lot of success with this, guys. One guy ordered 6 8-footers. We did a 30-footer for one guy.
Wow.
Put it up in his hangar. And
yeah, I'm going to have to order one of these.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at your email right now and they're pretty cool. What does a normal size go for? I have no idea how much these cost.
A 4-footer is $50.
Okay.
A 5-footer is $69.99. A 6-footer is $89.99. A 8-footer is $99.99.
Okay.
And if you want the unit patches, we charge another $20 for putting unit patches around the airplane and everything. It comes on a big strip and you can peel those off and put those wherever you want too. So $20 above the base price and we'll put the unit wing patches or top gun patch. And we've done some pretty cool patches for folks. One guy actually flew MiGs in the Red Eagle squadron. We actually did a Red Eagle patch for him and did his MiG-21 and his MiG-23. Yeah.
Cool.
Z-Man Rob Zettel.
So I have to ask though, Sluggo, this strikes me as something maybe some spouses wouldn't be too thrilled for. So I'm thinking man cave type stuff here, huh?
Yeah. Often we have people ask me, well, let me talk to my wife first and see what kind of space she's going to let me do this. But a couple of guys have their own hangers and put them up in their hangers and stuff. Normally we do between 4 and 5 footers pretty often. But the detail on them is incredible. These two guys that draw them for us and everything are just fantastic.
Well, I'm going to have to see if I can get the sweetheart deal from you, but I think I'm going to need one of these. My 403 would have been mine from VFA 94. So I'll get you all the numbers, but man, this has been a lot of fun, Sluggo. I forgot to ask you how many years of service and how many flight hours?
24 years, 6 months, 29 days, but nobody's counting, and almost 5,000 hours.
Wow.
In the 135.
Time of service is almost identical. I think I was almost exactly the same, but you've got me by about 1,200 hours. Of course, you get them by longer blocks at a time than I do. But
the really cool thing is I got to fly in other airplanes.
Yeah.
I've got S3 time.
Oh, nice. I don't even have that.
Off of the Shortney Gortney, Admiral Gortney, when he was CAG Air Wing 7. Mm-hmm. And I was out aboard right after Anaconda said, get him up. And I got to log 2.2 in a S3 Viking
That's cool.
I've got helicopter time. I've got E3 AWACS time, VC-10 time. I've got a lot of time in different airplanes, which was really a lot of fun.
Oh, good.
Absolutely a blast.
Well, what does the future hold for you there, Sluggo? You're doing speaking. You've got your wall pilot stuff. You're going to write any more books, or are you retiring up there in Utah?
I am writing another series of books.
All right.
To get young kids interested in aviation. A 15-year-old boy is befriended by a former astronaut who is building a Mach 6 capable vehicle in his backyard garage with parts he bought on eBay.
Okay. That sounds fun.
Yeah, 4 volumes in this book. And he follows in the old man's footsteps. The 4th book is he goes on his own Air Force career and ends up with the vehicle. And the antagonist is a North Korean Chinese pilot that the old man made the airplane to defeat, wow, to go after him. So it's going to be called Skybird, the Skybird series.
All right. Yep. Excellent. Well, be sure to let us know. We're going to have to keep in touch because you're just doing so much stuff I think the listeners are going to love. So you let us know when that comes out. We'll help you promote it and hopefully get a couple folks to get that. And this has just been a lot of fun. Before we let you go, though, you know the drill. We have to explain how someone came up with Sluggo for Mark Hacera. Come on now.
All of you got to be feeling really bad for my mom. I weighed 11 pounds. 10 pounds, 14 ounces, and was 23.5 inches tall when I was born. I got the pilot training and the nurse, you know, that takes all the medical forms and everything from your birth certificate, grabs it, and she's looking at it. She's going, 11 pounds, 23.5 inches tall. What a sluggo. And you're not going to live that down.
Wow. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. So the nurse gave you that's a first on this show. I don't think we've had that one before.
Yeah, she kind of set the tone for, and as you know, if you go to combat, that's the one you have, that's the one you keep. And
oh, yeah, unless you do something sufficiently stupid that it's worth a new one. But
and don't you and I have stories about that?
Oh, do we? We've told some here on the show, so
yeah.
All right, Sluggo, well, thanks for coming on today. You want to stick around for some listener questions?
I would love to.
All right, let's do it. All right. Thanks again, Sluggo. That was awesome. And I get the feeling we'll be hearing and seeing more of him. In fact, you already see him quite a bit if you are on our Aviation Photography Facebook group. He's pretty active on there. Now, Sluggo and I continued for almost another hour covering listener questions and other topics like refueling the SR-71, the crew size of the KC-135. By the way, it's a lot less than I expected, especially after listening to the AC-130 episode some time ago. Let's see, we talked about the massive refueling plan during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We even touched on stealth refueling coming up. So go check that out on Patreon if you're so inclined. That's where exclusive content like this lives. And it's featured there quite frequently. So go to patreon.com, search for the Fighter Pilot Podcast, and you can enjoy the exclusive content while helping support the show. Speaking of supporting the show, we want to thank our new Patreon strike leads, Jeanette Benoit, Daniel Cannon, Wesley Quinlan, and Nicholas Tierney. This is the part in the show I always like to remind you that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of myself and my guest and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. Well, I listened to the part one I recorded a little bit ago and noticed my P's were popping quite a bit. So if that's still happening, I apologize. Hopefully our producer Bernie from the Muscle Car Place podcast can help fix that up a little bit. But yeah, you just never know what you're going to get on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. Part of the reason is because I take my equipment with me when I go places and have to do the best in hotel rooms like this one in Atlanta, Georgia. So I know you appreciate what we try to do, and I know I appreciate your forgiveness for when our audio is not quite as great as it could be. Well, let's see, man, we have been churning out 3 episodes a month this entire year, even with some bonus episodes, and we have not yet taken a break. So guess what? We're going to take a break, take a week off next week, right around the Independence Day weekend here in North America. But don't worry, we have an intermission show lined up for you, and we're going to probably do something a little different in July. We'll announce more of that coming up. But don't worry, we're going to take a break, but we'll still have something for you to get your Fighter Pilot Podcast fix. So then, that'll do it for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Be well, be kind, be good to each other. Make each day a masterpiece, and we'll see you back here next time on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. So long.
You've been listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, brought to you by BVR Productions. Got a question for the show? Send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line at 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website at fighterpilotpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. For exclusive Fighter Pilot Podcast content, check out our Patreon page. Please like, follow, and subscribe to the show. And don't forget to share us with your network. Thank you for listening.
Hey, Jello. This is Kevin calling from Brampton, Ontario in Canada. I'm a new listener to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, and I must say that I am very pleasantly surprised with what I have come across. I happened to stumble across your MiG-21 episode in my Google News feed, and I found it very informative, entertaining, and just wow. Like, never thought I'd ever get to hear a naval fighter pilot speaking with an ex-Indian Air Commodore. So, just gotta say, great job, and have a good one, and keep up the good work. Thanks very much. Bye.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.